Faith Strong Today presents WikiGod with Mark Grollo. Hear new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe to the podcast at faithstrongtoday.com.
Well, hey friends, this is WikiGod, our stories shaping God in Toronto. And I'm your host, Mark Grollo, and this is the Uncut Faith Strong Today edition of the show. So WikiGod is a safe place. It's okay. Breathe a sigh of relief. Lay down your burdens and acknowledge that, you know what, I haven't heard everything there is to think about God. I don't know it all. Sometimes we feel like we have to. It's contingent on our good standing with God or something. But you know what? New ideas are good. We can talk to each other. We can wiki each other's stories and listen to someone else wiki their thoughts about God and explore new things, what might be possible for us. Well, this week, we're doing just that with Melinda Estabrooks. Now, if you're a Faith Strong Today listener, you're here, you know Melinda Estabrooks. She's got her own show. She's a speaker and a radio host, Your Story with Melinda. Check that out here on faithstrongtoday.com. But this time, I turned the tables. I got her to sit on the other side of the mic. Yeah, she's used to digging into other people's stories, but it was time for her to tell hers. And what a story it is. She talks to me about growing up, straddling church life and club life, and never really feeling fully herself in either place. And ultimately, she talks about coming to grips with the real life extension of grace as pure gift and how that formulated her perception of God as a loving parent, which is something I totally agree with and resonate with theologically, ironically, kind of because of opposite experiences. She was extended grace, I definitely wasn't, and yet we landed in the same place. So it's like God is wooing and calling us home when we see it that way, when we unpack our stories. You're going to love this. Without further ado, let's get right to it. Here we go. Let's wiki some God with, you know her, you love her, Melinda Estabrooks. It's funny because I'm kind of expecting, when you go to your website, what, storyteller and speaker? So I think I should just be able to like sit, lean back and just let you talk for 45 minutes.
That's fine.
That's my expectation. Okay. Here. So it'll be easiest interview ever.
Okay.
Where you're just going to start spinning out stories.
One after another.
45 minutes, I will ring a bell and say, thank you. That was wonderful.
And I'll say, thanks, Mark, for the no questions.
Yeah,
and for
exactly.
Letting me just
Well, we
be
have
the
a
platform.
Lot on paper here,
yeah.
But you're a storyteller. So yes. Just go nuts. So I don't know. You're setting that standard for yourself, storyteller.
Yeah.
So let's get you kick-started. Because there's so many things.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what's my oeuvre to Melinda? But let's go back to because a lot of your story is actually like, some people it's like just backstory. Oh, I grew up, blah, blah. But for you, that is a huge part of your story.
Yes.
Your childhood, little Melinda. So.
And I'm still little.
Oh, I wasn't going to mention that.
But yes, little Melinda. You want to know about me as a little Melinda?
I don't want to give the year. You blog about the year, but we don't need to know your age. But yeah, like what? So you're Filipino.
I'm Filipino, but and I was adopted.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say little Melinda, I was adopted at 1 week old out of an orphanage and actually out of a place called the Abiertas House of Friendship.
Hmm.
And I know that we'll get into the story throughout this time.
We're in it right now.
We're in it right now.
So what's that?
Okay.
Was that a religious house?
It was
an order of some sort?
Yeah, it was part of a service that whether it was the city or whatnot, had to support unwed mothers who had their babies. They would have them in the hospital and then give them up, but they would be able to stay and be there for 2 or 3 days to recover after they had the baby.
Huh.
And so they were well taken care of. And then once they left, the girls, the baby would stay and then they would find a home for the baby.
Okay.
So, yeah. So let's do a backstory quickly.
Even before 1 week old. Okay.
Yes. Even before 1 week old. So my mom and dad, Paul and Diane Estabrooks, are actually Canadian.
Paul and Diane.
Yes. Based out of London, Ontario. My mom, Diane, was a school teacher. My dad worked in TV and hung out with the likes of like Lloyd Robertson and Anne Murray way back when they were these young, keen, young people who wanted to change the world. And they were sort of on this trajectory of what I would say sort of the Canadian dream was. You know, they had two young kids. They had great jobs. They had a great community, great church. And that was, they really believed their life. and that was what it was going to be.
Hmm.
Until they went down to Urbana one year, and if you know Urbana, it's that big missions conference of like 20,000 people that happens every year in the States. And as they were walking down the hallway, my dad looked over and saw this booth that said Far East Broadcasting Company.
Huh.
And he says the only thing he can explain it was that the spirit or this strong sense of urgency pulled him towards this booth. And it was about needing radio broadcasters to broadcast the gospel of Jesus to places like to China and to the forests of the Philippines and into places where nobody could get to.
Wow.
And at that point, of course, it's so funny now thinking there was no online or internet. And there
This is the 70s, right?
Like late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah. So this would be like shortwave radio.
It was shortwave radio,
in
absolutely.
Villages,
yes.
People. Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
And he goes, it was crazy. And they just knew instantly that they had to go. Huh. Well, that didn't go over well with their family, even their church. People said, why are you going to a country full of cannibals?
Whoa.
I was like, oh, what do you mean? But in that time, no one knew Asia, knew the Philippines. But
this is the 1970s.
Yes.
Not the
cannibals.
70s. Okay.
Now, do I look like a cannibal, Mark? Like, look at me.
You've cleaned up nice.
I think. So they went, and much to the chagrin and angst of family, and even, you know, the community who didn't want them to go, they went.
That's
and
very,
that
like,
time,
counter to, like, my Anabaptist-y.
It is.
Like, because you're supposed to, seek discernment from your community.
I
like,
know,
against
but,
everything.
But there was fear.
There must have been some confirmations for them.
There were. But I think for a lot of people, there was fear. And also, you know, that sense of his family. Like, you're going away. And at that time, you could only, like, once in a while do a phone call and then letter writing, right? So they went. And when they went, you know, I've talked to my parents, you know, a lot about this. They said immediately their heart was broken because there was so much need and poverty. A lot of, at that time, young babies, especially girls, were being thrown in the rivers on the side of the roads because they were unwanted.
Wow.
And there was something sort of brewing in them that they needed to do something. They didn't know yet, but my mom got pregnant and then had a really devastating miscarriage.
Mm.
And at that point, my parents looked at each other and said, we can, you know, grieve and be upset and be angry at God, or we can say, God, how do we make this situation turn into something good?
Was that their first child?
No, so it was their third.
Okay,
and they wanted,
so they've already got
They had two kids, Tim and Tanya, and they wanted a third child. And so they lost one in a miscarriage, and then they decided, listen, we feel this need for a third child, and our hearts have been broken for these babies, so I think God's saying something.
I have no idea where this
God.
Is going.
Yeah. I know, but it's such a mystery where this led.
It's amazing.
And at that point, my mom was volunteering at the Arbiatus House of Friendship.
Uh-huh.
And they said, we want, you know, the next baby girl that comes through. And it was me.
Mm.
But there's so many parts of that story because I really, I guess I'm very mindful. And it makes me sometimes, A, either cry or B, sit in absolute awe and wonder about how I really got here, because there's many factors that I shouldn't have been adopted at that time. There was another baby that came their way and then that didn't work out. The way I came about was a really bad situation for my birth mother, Dory, and I shouldn't have ended up there. Like, there's all these factors.
So you're probably intrinsically connected to this idea of just contingency, vulnerability, kind of the randomness, but not of life. I mean, as I get older, I've struggled with that idea that, what do you mean I'm not in control? What do you mean? Like, I'm forging my destiny. But then when you step back, I heard somebody recently talk about like seeing their heart on a sonogram. It's like, what's keeping that thing beating? I don't know. Like, it's everything is just so out of our hands.
It is.
And you must, that is so part of your story. Like, your life could have been so, you could be a cannibal.
Yeah, I could be a cannibal. I may still be, just hidden deep down. No one knows it yet.
That's
and I think it's coming out now during this interview.
That's a Wiki God excuse.
And I think that's it. I think the start of that has really driven and formed the formation of my faith. Because when I sit and realize just how much me being here happened, there's no chance in that. Like, I really believe that there was a God moving on so many people's lives and decisions. And I also believe that there's a lot of weight on the choices we make.
Right.
Because if my parents hadn't gone to the Philippines, if they had listened to other people, if my birth mother Dory had not gone through with the pregnancy, even though she wanted to have an abortion, if her friends hadn't brought her to the Iberian House of Friendship, like there's all these parts that kind of came together, and here I am. Yeah. Like that's the only way I can explain it, because that's seriously how it happened. And so I think, even throughout my life, though I struggled with my faith or identity and self-esteem, I could never really deny God and God as Father and God as a faithful friend, Father, who has been with me all my life.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was supposed to be my closing question.
Oh. You can edit that and take that out. And
that whole like sense of who is God to you. Yeah, but I mean, for you, it is right out of the gate. And I was wondering about, like, you used the word weight. Have you felt another kind of weight, like in the sense of, I don't know, I'm chosen, almost like a survivor guilt. Like, was my life supposed to be this huge, I don't know. Do you sometimes feel that? Like,
the
why
that,
did God choose me?
Yes.
Kind of like what you see in scripture. Like, for those of us who are just born to a family and, you know, in the suburbs, and it's like, yeah. But I don't know, maybe when I hear your story, is there a sense of like, am I supposed to be the chosen one of some sort?
Yeah, you know what? That's interesting. I've actually been thinking about that just recently, because I felt that there has been a responsibility on me about this story. I've realized as I've gotten older that it's not really my story, it's God's story. And for me to not share God's story is probably something I shouldn't do. As in that sense of, I feel very much intrinsically like it's his story for me to tell. And I'm just a part of it.
Okay.
But, you know, as I was struggling through my teen years and making really bad choices for myself, I mean, I really identified with the prodigal son, prodigal daughter. I had a lot of struggles when I first came back to Canada when I was 13, and it was the first time I ever felt racism.
Oh, wow. 13. That's
I was in Asia. I lived in the Philippines and Singapore, and my life was international. You know, I had friends that were all from different countries, and so I never felt different.
So did you come back to London?
Yeah, no, I came back into actually Loring Park in Mississauga, and at that time it was a very Caucasian WASP community, and it was the first time, you know, somebody identified me automatically, like I was the maid, or who was this brown kid, or also even being adopted was really different for people. So there was always these like weird looks, you know, oh, you're adopted, I'm so sorry. And that, you know, as a young girl, that was really hard, because I'm like, I've never been different. And this is being different because of just color, or being different because of being adopted, which was something that was celebrated and good, you know, in Philippines and Singapore. And so that was really hard. And so rather than, you know, go to my parents or even just be like, hey, God, I mean, I had a really great relationship with him. I talked to him a lot. But at this point, I'm like, this isn't working. I got to go and find, you know, fun and acceptance somewhere else. And so, like, I got fake ID. I was in the clubs. I was drinking. I was doing drugs. I was, you know,
so that's how you kind of curried favor with peers, is being that girl.
And I was that girl. I wanted to be, you know, the life of the party, and being a natural extrovert, it was pretty easy just to do that.
Yeah.
And then the club scene was right into what I loved. You know, I loved the dancing, the music, the social part of it. And thought that was going to really sort of like cure this deep rooted sense of insecurity and identity. And so, but my story from my life has always talked about sort of this identity, who I am in God, because you can get totally, I don't know, just confused about identity if you're not really focused on, you know, sort of who you are with God. Because I was like, well, people said that, you know, I'm this and I'm that, and I didn't see myself on the cover of Vogue or InStyle or Cosmo. And it's like, you know what, nobody likes a Filipino girl. Like, I'm not an example of beauty or acceptance. No guys like this isn't what beauty is. And so I get that. I get the struggle of women, you know, because you're always comparing about what's ideal.
Yeah.
And I wasn't.
Okay.
Or so I thought.
Like that standard.
Yeah, the standard,
the magazine,
right?
Cover standard.
Yeah, yeah. And so I lost my way. I mean, during that time, I tried to commit suicide, and it was a miraculous.
This is in your teens?
Yeah, my teens. And
what was what were your parents like? How were they?
You know, it was really hard.
Did they feel a huge sense of, I think, of my daughter? Like, where did I go wrong if that happened?
I mean, I've talked to my parents now. I mean, they'll say a lot of times they had no idea what to do, so they would just get on their knees and pray. And so I say to a lot of parents, like, if you don't know, get on your knees and just pray and just like bring and call heaven down and say, God, protect my kid, and somehow do it, because I have no idea what's going on. So they prayed a lot. But I think there was, I think it was really hard for a missionary family being away for so long to come back into Canada and try to reintegrate. I have a real soft spot for people that are missionaries who are like coming back in because the church and community need to support them. It's really hard. You know, you're gone for 13 years and you're Canadian, you come back and you're more Asian than you're Canadian, you're thinking and you're eating and the way you are. And it was really difficult for the entire family. And it was a really hard time for our family in that. So I think my parents did the best they could, but it was really hard too, because we kind of came back in the time when we all were teenagers and trying to find our way. And so,
So did your other siblings, did they also have this period?
Like,
it was kind of across the board for your whole family. Everyone was like, whoa.
We all kind of went, whoa. It really was like that. And so, you know, it's funny because people say, when you try to commit suicide, did you want to die? And I said, actually, no. It was more like, I was just so overwhelmed by these feelings. I had had a tough, like, you know, relationship with a guy. He was pressuring me to have sex. I didn't want to. And I was having problems with my mom and wasn't fitting in. It was like, I, as a young person, we were still trying to form your ideas and boundaries and how to be. I didn't know how to do it. So the only thing I thought of was like, I just need to escape it. And so I went in and to my mom's cupboard and took like 2/3 of a bottle of extra strength Tylenol and passed out, gone. And interesting enough, when my mom came home, she had a headache and went to reach for the bottle and was like, she goes, wait a second, I just bought this at Costco. It was full. Why is it almost empty? Realized it could be me. Ran upstairs and I was passed out. Raced me to the hospital, and they pumped my stomach, and the doctor said, you're so lucky, because if it was any longer, you might not have been around. And so I was in the hospital for 2 days on suicide watch. And then eventually had to do like a year of group therapy for kids under like 16 and under through the government. You had to attend, and which was really freaky, because I always thought, me, I'm not that far out. I'm not that bad. And here I am with like all kinds of like messed up kids who were sitting around in group therapy. So,
but that has probably opened, like, demythologized or destigmatized kids like that. Like, you
yeah,
can probably,
it was, because
even
I sat
now,
around.
You can probably just relate to kids like
I sat around and looked at these people. I mean, an arsonist and a schizophrenic and multiple personality and a compulsive liar. And like, we were all this whole motley crew of people. And I'm like, am I one of you? And then they thought I was crazy because I tried to commit suicide. And I'm like, actually, you tried to burn like a downtown Toronto building down. Like, I'm crazy. You're crazy. Like, it was nuts. And the other guy was like, hi, I'm now a young girl. He's like, oh, no, come home. You know, like, it was just like, it was one of those things. But
you're giving a glimpse of what it must be like to moderate this group of kids.
It was
but I'm still stuck on your mom's headache. Like, that's incredible. Your mom gets a headache.
And she
goes to the
and,
bottle like that.
Yeah,
is
and
incredible.
I was upstairs, and like she would have
known. That's like razor's edge kind of process of events. Oh my goodness!
But see, I in the every little part of those events, I'm very keenly aware that I believe absolutely that God is in the midst of all of this. Like he just, you know, people go, how I go, it's just God senses and he kind of moves people and sort of directs people, helps people along. And, you know, and you'd think that after that, I would get my act together. And of course, no, I headed to the clubs again. And I mean, it was just a mess. Like I was involved with, you know, hung out with some of the guys in some mafia downtown Toronto and just got into a lot of just not good situations. And yet it was funny. I talked to friends now years later. And they said, Melinda, it was really interesting because we go to the clubs, you would only go so far, but you couldn't go the next step. And I was like, what do you mean? They said, there was always something that held you back. I go, really? They said, yeah, it's like, you could club, you could be great, you could meet guys, but you'd always like, we'd kind of go one more step. We'd open the door, we'd try one more hard drug or whatever, and you'd always just feel like somebody was stopping you. Like somebody always sort of like, you always felt like you just couldn't. And I would laugh. I said, really? They said, yeah, every time we'd see it. And I said, yeah. And they said, I think it was your faith. As much as we thought you were such a hypocrite, you'd always make it to church on Sunday, even though you club and do all your stuff the rest of the days. Somebody, something always kept you safe. And I mean, this is years later, people who aren't of faith or Christian yeah. saying these things to me. Wow. And so I'm like, wow, it's
cut,
true.
And cut to your parents praying at home.
Absolutely. I believe it. And yeah. and I believe that really was one of those saving things that, that saved mm-hmm. me throughout my childhood.
Wow. So can we kind of unpack, because that, yeah. that was new information there. So you're going to, you're doing a church thing on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you woke up for that.
Barely.
After your Saturday night.
Barely.
But I mean, so that was happening at the same time. So what's going on for you in terms of God? Was it all a show? Was it a struggle? Were you mm-hmm. having an existential crisis, or was it all an act?
It was all. I was acting.
At church or at the club? Like, or was
I was
it,
acting at the church
were you
and
being,
I was acting
being
at the
characters.
Club.
Yeah,
yeah,
you were playing
really
characters.
I was. That's a really good way to put it, because there would be guilt in both places mm. because I felt that I wasn't truly myself. I felt very much close to God. And yet there are times where I would say to him when I go to the club, you know what? I just don't want to be with you around you. So I'm going to go to the club and have some fun. And I'll get back to you.
Because you're not there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Reminds me of a story of a guy with a big fish thrown in the water. You're not there.
Yeah, right. You know, and so I was. And, you know, there were people who would say to me, Melinda, you'd be so hypocritical.
Mm.
And, you know, those were the worst kinds of things that could be said. But I would take it in stride and be like, yeah, yeah, you know. Because I was still not fully fulfilled. It was like, God, I know you're real. And I know that my life means something.
Mm.
But, you know, what the church and what I'm experiencing isn't fun. And it's not doing anything for me.
Mm.
And in the clubs, I'm feeling alive and exciting and shiny and what I want people to believe I am and who I am.
Mm.
And yet I felt that I couldn't be that person at the church.
Yeah.
So there was always tension. And yet I think that's a good way of saying it. I was acting on both because it'd be like I'd be trying to be this like kind of badass girl at the club, but really everybody knew I really wasn't. Because
yeah.
I couldn't really go that
yeah,
far.
That thing is
but then I'd be
stop
at the church
you.
I'm like, yeah. yeah, you know, and you know, I'd be talking about my weekend, and yet, you know, I feel kind of guilty and be like, you know, it wasn't probably the best decision. So I was always waffling back and forth. And, you know, even just getting baptized and even feeling guilty then, you know, at 18 going, you know, I'm getting baptized because I know that I need to do this. But I know, like, tomorrow night's an awesome big party and I'm just going to, like, get wasted and just party.
Yeah.
So, God, you know, I'm going down in the water, but tomorrow I'll be, like, you know, yeah. like, partying. So
I just love how this kind of, again, Wiki God is about kind of our stories shaping God. Your story portrays this God who is so patient. Like,
yes.
Oh, Melinda, fine. Get that's, baptized. Go to your party tomorrow.
Like, you know what, Mark? That's exactly it. And, you know, that's, I really hear him. And when he speaks, that's how I hear him.
Mm.
Because
the deep sigh.
Yes. And the, and honestly, always the, oh, Melinda. Mm. And not in a, you know, patronizing way, but in a very beautiful, patient, mm-hmm. loving father way.
Yeah.
Because he knows me so well that he knows and knew that I have this part of myself that needs that. And and yet it was, you know, it's true. I think that even within the club, there are times where I would actually hear his voice amidst the loud music saying, don't go in there. There's one moment, I will say this. I was going to go into this room with these people. And I was walking through the room and I was at this club and it was like loud music, probably some good old house music, my favorite. And I heard this loud voice say, don't go in. And I turned around, I looked at my girlfriend and went, did you say something? She goes, no, she's yelling. She was like, how can I say anything? And I keep walking and I hear, Melinda, don't go in there. I have a much better plan for you. And I turned around again and I said, did somebody say something to me? And they were like, no. And I was like, I think that's God. And I remember at that moment almost going to the room and said, hey, girls, I can't. And I turned around, I called a cab, and I went home. And the next day in the news, some pretty bad stuff happened in that room and in that club.
And it was in the news, like enough to be in the news. Wow.
And, you know, over and over again, that has been my story. Like, I hear God so clearly. Sometimes that clearly, other times just sort of that feeling within me to do or not do something.
Yeah.
And that's
like, so in that period of your life, those are kind of warnings.
Yeah.
I was reading your blog, and again, this is a question that I have, so this is a good segue. We'll ask it now.
Okay.
Like, you're somewhat of a mystic. Like, God, even in a club, God is, like, cutting through the house music and the shouting. So I guess I don't need to ask how you hear God. It seems to be, like, a voice that is outside of you that would be... Would that be right, or do you hear God different ways?
Outside and inside. I journal a lot. I write. Mm. And in my time in my early 20s, I went on a mission trip, and I was really challenged by some of the leaders to write and just ask God to sort of write his thoughts. And first I'm like, well, that's my thoughts. And they said, right, but it's also his thoughts. I'm like, no, but it's my thoughts. I'm writing it. And I had this battle. But here's the thing I'm learning about being with God and the Holy Spirit, because people ask me this question, number one question. I don't hear it from God. I don't hear God. How do you know? And yet I go, well, here's the thing. If his Spirit is in you and you've made that decision to follow him and he's with you, then he's going to speak, and he's going to speak in a way that you know. Maybe it's in your own voice, or maybe it's in a familiar way. Like, he's not going to sound like Morgan Freeman every time, right? Like, sometimes he sounds like that, but not really. It's going to be in a way you know, and they're like, well, what... How do you know it's him? I said, because it's going to be always good stuff. Like, it's not going to be contrary to who he is and his character. And yet, you know what, Mark, I really believe I've always had a very simple faith. I've really believed and trusted him. I haven't doubted. So I hear him all the time, and he speaks to me and says things to me. And so I write, I hear him. I hear him sometimes audibly, but then a lot of times I hear in sort of the sense of his presence, and a sense, sometimes that prickly sensation up your neck, and I just sense it. I'm like, that's him. Or I'll be just walking, talking, and he'll say, you know, pray for that man right now, this specific prayer. And I'm like, okay, and I will pray. I've prayed for probably thousands of random people I see every day, and he's told me to do things like go to that woman in the Starbucks and tell her that, you know, ask her how she's doing and tell her that she's known and loved.
Wow.
Random.
So you're that creepy, weird lady who does things like that in Starbucks.
Yeah, that's me. It's only happened, I think, once or twice, but it's been freaky.
So you've had to cultivate that, though. I mean, that's not just a switch. Like, you have to walk in that. You have to have the courage to act on that.
But I realize this, is that every day, probably most people pray for something, and I believe that a lot of times we're the answer to people's prayers. Like, they say, I'm alone, or I need a sign, and a lot of times we miss it because we're too afraid that we're gonna look stupid, or that that's silly. And I go, but here's the thing, you know, even I pray for things, and a lot of times they're answered because somebody, a friend, called me or felt this urge or need, or you know, to connect with me. I'm like, you won't believe this, but I actually was just praying that I needed this kind of like word or comfort or something. And
it sounds very self-involved to say we are the answer to our prayers, but when you look even at the testimony of scripture, the book of Acts, where all this crazy stuff is happening, it's always happening through other people. Like Paul, the Ananias thing, Ananias had to go and be like, are you Paul? And you know, like, it's always God putting people in touch with other people, and those people having the courage to say things.
It's true.
It's constant.
And I like to encourage my friends, you need to exercise this. Like, people are alone and lonely because we're not extending friendship and mercy and, you know, community around them. So, you know, they're saying, God, I need a friend, and yet we are those people. And for many of us, there are moments where I feel we've missed it. And I have. I'm like, shoot, I really sense that. But I thought, that's a little extreme. Because what's the worst that could happen? People look at you and go, that's weird. Okay, well, whatever, you know. But so I've been trying to really be like, when I hear him, to do it. And I don't do it 100% of the time. But when I do it, a lot of times I don't know if there's any impact. But other times I do. People go, you won't believe this, Melinda, but I actually was praying that specifically. I'm like, wow, that's cool. And that's really God. So I've been... that's been, though, a lifelong thing. I've been working on that and you know, kind of figuring that out, and, you know, having the courage to do it, and but also not apologizing for it. You know, I know, like, a lot of my friends are from so many different backgrounds denominationally, and whether you're evangelical or you're more mainline, and I just said, you know, I just want to be in that place of hearing from him, from God, and then doing what he wants me to do. It's pretty simple.
Simple, but the execution.
Okay,
is
the execution. But but it is. And once you start doing it, then it's not so scary.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's how I'm kind of living these days.
So I hear like you're so beautifully portraying this God as parent feeling and relationship. How did you avoid God as angry Zeus? Like,
that's
my upbringing. I've been trying to exorcise that demon and kill that God. it's almost like the angel and demon, but it's instead it's God and God on my shoulder. Like there, I know there's the loving parent. Jesus talks about the Father. That was what's so radical about Jesus' teaching is the Abba stuff that just kind of didn't exist then. But then there's my upbringing of God is gonna, like, even when you're in clubs, like you said, you felt guilt, but I'm not hearing you say, I was afraid God would incinerate me, or, you know, the way you hear people say, I'd never go to a church, I'd never darken the door because I'd burst into flames. There's that constant, like, I don't hear that in your story.
Because it never.
How did you miss that?
Because there never was that. You know why? I think it's because I had a very loving father. I had a very loving dad who exemplified, I think, everything that God is, but in an earthly way. So, and how that happened is where I really believe, like I, you know, said this prayer when I was six with my dad, but I really feel my conversion of really Sam following Jesus was in my early 20s. And that was because my dad forgave me in a story that I really share when I speak on the Father's love. I was in a really abusive relationship with a guy. It was 4 years of just a bad relationship. It was a sexual relationship. It was just emotionally abusive. It was horrible. And lied to my parents all about it and what we were doing. We broke up, and this man decided to go to my dad and tell him everything that we had done, whether it was to appease his own guilt or get me in trouble. And it was horrible. And I came home. I was at Bible college at the time. I came home, and my sister said, you were in so much trouble. Like, Dad and Mom heard from him everything you've done for the past 4 years, and Dad's been crying for 3 weeks about it. And I said, what? And, you know, the dad who I absolutely love, like, it was sort of like God number one, and then my dad a close second, almost like one, but two.
Yeah.
And I went up to my room, and my room was beautifully cleaned, and new curtains and new bedspread. And I said, Tanya, you know, to my sister, like, what happened? She goes, what's funny? Dad had was crying and was so hurt by the lies that you had done, and just, you just sort of betrayed his trust. And yet he went out and bought you a whole new bedroom set and cleaned your room so it'd be beautiful when you got home. And I've never cried like that in my life. I was emotionally a wreck. I wrote I'm sorry to my parents letter and gave it to them. And then the next day, my dad had to drive me back to Bible college, because nobody else surprisingly could. And I remember, Mark, getting in the car, and my thoughts were, I deserve, you know, my dad to say these things. And in my head, these were the things that were in my head. I said, I deserve my dad to say, you're such a whore, you're such a slut. I'm so embarrassed, you know, that you're my daughter. I'm a missionary and pastor, and how embarrassing, look what you've done. And yet, none of that happened. And then we got to Bible college, and I was waiting for my dad to then embarrass me in front of everybody at the college about, you know, what a hypocrite I was. And we get out of the car, and he says, Melinda, you know, thank you for the note. He says, I forgive you. He goes, you'll always be my daughter. And well, we won't talk about this again, but I love you and will always love you. And at that moment, Bible college education couldn't teach me anything about the heart of God. But my father taught me everything. So that's why I've spoken to a number of churches and men's groups about the father heart, because I said, how you are as a dad to your daughter, to your kids, actually will determine a lot of how they see God. And that was a turning point. At that point, it was like, honestly, it was like the heavens opened up at the Bible college, and it was like God was saying, there it is. So all your sins are exposed. Everything was exposed to the man that you love, like your dad. And how your dad reacted is how I react. Is, you're still my daughter. I love you. You're forgiven. I want the best for you. That's why I'm sad. I want the best for you. And now you have a decision to make. And that was it. I made that decision in my early 20s. Mm. That changed the trajectory of my life. And, you know, my dad and I have a very special relationship. And that's why I've never seen an angry father figure. I've never experienced that. And so for me, that's been, I think, a real, whether it's a blessing or gift to have a dad, like an earthly dad that is like that, is pretty awesome. And I realize that as I get older and I go about my life, a lot of people don't have that. It's actually really sad. Like, I talk about my dad, people are like, I have no idea what that's like.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? You're like, no, I don't know what that's like to have a dad like that, or to have a dad be so forgiving and so open and caring and loving. So
have you talked to your dad about, like, how he cultivates that? Is that just, can that be written off as, oh, his personality? Or,
no,
because
his
dad
was pretty harsh. Yeah. Like his dad was a pastor.
Okay.
And his dad was pretty sort of that old school. You know, it's a good question. I should talk to him about that, because all my life that was my dad. Hmm. It was his character. And, you know, anywhere I am with my dad, because my dad is in his own right, he's a speaker, he's an author of like a gazillion books. Hmm. He's right now, like, speaking in Malaysia with the persecuted church, like, pastors on how to stand strong through persecution. Like, he's amazing. Mm. And again, I think for my dad, you know, his call on his life is, and his love of God has been the one thing, too, that I've seen and witnessed as something that I'm like, man, I want to be like that. Mm. I want to be that kind of person.
Yeah.
So as far as the angry God, like, you know, it's funny, Mark, because I've never blamed God for anything. Anything that's happened bad to me, I'm like, oh my goodness, that's totally my fault. Like, it is. And if people say that to me, they said, wouldn't you be angry because of all these things that have happened to you, whether it's this, this, and this? I'm like, no, because I did it.
Mm.
They're like, yeah, but I said, no, I clearly walked into that and chose that bad thing. Mm. Or somebody did that to me. So you can't blame God. Like, I honestly,
that again is a version of God. This sense that, like, God should have, like, hooked your neck and pulled you.
Yeah,
like,
I'm like, no.
God kind of just said, again, that you're okay, you're choosing that. That sucks.
I go, you're an adult and you made your choice.
Yeah.
So why would you blame God on that? Because that's you.
That's where that prodigal story is so potent, right?
Yeah.
Like, that Jesus told, like, the son go, like, okay, bye.
Yeah. Why do you have a sense of angry God?
Me?
Yeah.
Hey, you're not supposed to ask me questions. This is the interview. Hello.
Oh, okay.
That's the interviewer in you. Oh. No, just my upbringing was very, like, God is controlling. Like, that, God was not, that was not in the paradigm, this loving father. Mm-hmm. It was an authoritarian. I mean, that is a lot of the impetus behind even what I do. It oozes out. But again, the God that is presented to us by people's stories, and that was, I guess, my pastor's story. He was an American. He was a veteran, like Vietnam boot camp.
Right.
He came and planted a church in Canada. My dad started attending and just kind of went all wholesale into, like, God is a sergeant. God is a drill sergeant. Mm-hmm. It's incredible, but that is how I was raised, that you step out of line and you're going to get punished. And so it was like military God.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
And that was
though?
Right out of that pastor's experience that got translated and affected a whole generation of youth, and some, you know, fell away, still hate God, and all kinds of problems that resulted from that. So I'm just getting reacquainted with, like, the radicality of Jesus saying, call God Abba, like daddy. Like, that's such a almost infantile teaching point, but it's so powerful.
Yeah.
It's incredible that he could say that to
and
the population
I
of his day.
Yeah, I know, and I get that. I mean, people have said to me sometimes, it's, you know, Mel, you come at, you know, your faith and relationship as a child. And I said, I think that's right. And I said, because I've always looked at God that way, as Abba Father, always provider, and, you know, one that cares and loves. And so that's why it's so easy for me when people are like, you know, why Jesus? Why this relationship? It's because I think I've seen it and know it, that it's, I'm like, how, why not?
Yeah.
And so they're like, oh, well, okay. Well, that's not the response I thought I was going to get. You're just like, well, why not? But it really is. And so whether it's too simple, I'm okay with that. Because I think that's it. I don't think it's complicated. I think that's the relationship. I think that's what he wants. Like, a good relationship isn't complicated with, like, all these, like, hidden things. It's like, it's pretty clear. It's like, you know, I love you, you love me, we're committed to each other, and, you know, we sacrifice for one another and we care for each other deeply. And I've really felt that. I've really had that my whole life.
Well, if your faith is simple, as you say it, or you're, I mean, it's strongly grounded in relationship. It's very relational.
Yeah.
Somebody else might say, it's simple. It's just you got to believe in these four spiritual laws, right? Like that's another, and that's where it's like, that's not relational.
No, that's not
that's like, that's a mental ascent and you have to believe mm-hmm. in these three, four things that all have all kinds of implications. So I think, yeah, for you, that kind of simple is different than that other kind of simple.
Yeah,
you know? Like
true.
It's not about assenting to simple things that then mm-hmm. have all kinds of, I think it's very consistent with the Abba teaching, and it just feels, I mean, your dad forgiving you, that's the dad that I hope to be. I've talked about it very freely on the podcast that mm-hmm. I have anger stuff, and it really, it's hard for me because I have a daughter, and I, already at the age of 3, I'm constantly saying to her, like, Daddy shouldn't have said that, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. And I didn't grow up in an apologizing context. Mm-hmm. It's like, parents do no wrong, you just do it. And, you know, I don't want to throw any, my parents under the bus here, but I've adopted a bit of that anger somehow from upbringing, mm-hmm. and I'm having to say to my 3-year-old, like, oh, daddy didn't act the way he should have there. And I hope that that somehow redeems the times that I'm not the dad I want to be,
mm-hmm.
is that I don't just fake my way through it. I'm just like, oh, daddy's very human.
No, kids know. Have a lot of, you know, a lot of grace. And I think that, you know, I mean, like I said, my parents weren't perfect, but yeah, they apologized and they were open. And even as my dad gets older, you know, it's really cool. We were just on a trip just recently together and we had like days to just hang out and talk about life. Mm. And it was awesome. And just he was so open about his own life and things. And I think that as you get older and parents are more open and are quick to just say, I'm sorry, I messed up, I think that makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's really key, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was good. I feel really... Like, of any family that I could have been adopted into, I'm like, yes.
Score.
Score. Because it could have been anybody, right? I mean, honestly, it could have been anybody. I mean, it could have still been in the Philippines. It could have been adopted by any family. And God really chose the Estabrooks, and it's been really awesome.
So you really believe in the power of story. Like, just on your website, you say... Yeah, I'll speak at your thing. Depression, attempted suicide, divorce. You're like, check.
Yeah.
I'll talk about that stuff.
Sure.
I mean, that's, you are intimately equated with all of the above, but what compels you to talk about them? I mean, you hinted earlier, like, this is God's story, but why are you talking about all this stuff?
Well, it was
why is it out there? Why are you putting it out there?
I know, because we were like, wow, it's a lot of stuff.
Whoa, TMI, Melinda.
Yeah,
TMI.
Exactly. I think where it really came down to it, just more recently, was when I was talking about my divorce, when I shared about my divorce on the air on Full Circle, 100 Huntley Street, and the response was overwhelming.
Mm.
Within days, I was receiving... letters and phone calls and emails of people saying, first of all, we've never heard of a Christian person who is a host of a show in Canada be that bold and open to say that what's happening.
So you shattered the taboo.
Yeah. Second, let me tell you my story. Mm. And Mark, heartbreaking. Mm. Like, I was on the floor of my office bawling. Stories of absolute pain of people going through divorce that were hurt, or people who were like, you know, in our day, if you were divorced, if your husband left you and divorced, then you were divorced and you'd be kicked out of the church. Mm. And why people hated the church. And it was so heartbreaking. And
wow.
I realized at that point that we need to share our story so that everybody knows that we're all in it together.
Mm.
We're all in the same place. Because they kept saying, we would never expected you. You look so perfect on TV. Your hair is always done. And I said, yeah, great stylist and great makeup artist. And I said, you always look like you have it all together. I'm like, yeah, no, had a not great marriage and now it's out.
Mm.
And then I realized that I needed to share my story so that other people could get healing, could be open and could have the courage to share theirs. And again, like I said, God really, and it was funny because I remember saying to God, listen, God, I've talked about, you know, my youth and being the prodigal daughter. And I've talked about my, you know, adoption. But please don't make me talk about my divorce.
Mm.
Like, that is really a sensitive one. It's mm-hmm. one of where I had to really struggle about my issues with rejection and abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
Please don't. And he was silent. And usually he kind of talks to me, and he was silent for the first while. And so I went through a really hard time, you know, in the year of separation and going through it.
Mm.
And as I was coming out of it and getting stronger and had shared on TV and gotten stronger, it was, I'm not even kidding, I was journaling one day because I was seeing a great Christian counselor. And I was journaling one day after she had talked, and I heard him, and he said, "Soon you'll be ready." And I went, "No." No. And he's like, "Yep." And within a month, a church called me and said, "We heard that you've been going through a divorce. We don't know if it's too soon, but could you come and talk to our church about your, we don't need to know about why in the divorce, but how you got through it." And that was it. And I went, "Oh, man." And for the past 6 years, it's funny, like one of the top things that people want me to talk about is that is how I got through divorce. Wow. And I said, well, I can talk about that, but I also want to talk about receiving the church at its best. Because in the midst of it all, I received so much love from the church. And people said, that's not an experience most people have.
Yeah.
You know, like Crossroads, which a lot of people expected would sort of like kick me off the air, kept me and gave me work and love me through it. You know, at the time I was on the board of the Meeting House, and Brexy and Tim were like, I said, "I think I better step off the board." Look at me, and they're like, "No, you're going to stay on the board, and we're going to love you through this." And over and over and over again, the places in which so much pain has happened to others within church context or ministry loved me and supported me and continue to do so. I mean, I really feel like the recipient of a lot of grace and mercy and love. Like, it's really unbelievable. And I say this to people, it's like when people do that, when they love instead of judge, and when they extend mercy, you know, instead of gossip and all that, then someone like me can still be in ministry and still honestly be, you know, in love with Jesus in a true sense.
Church, it's striking me now, the church is so much like your dad that day at the car. Like, there was a left and a right. It was almost like your dad could have dragged you through the mud, berated you on that drive. And the church does that a lot to people. Like you say, the things you expected to happen, that has happened. You got those letters of the church saying, "You're out, you're done."
Yeah.
You're like, your dad could have done that, or your dad could have done the thing that he did.
Yeah.
And the church is the same. But because there's so many people, every single day it's choosing,
right?
Unfortunately.
And I think that's it. That's when I speak is, you know, I share all this, but at the very end of every time I speak, I encourage. I say, listen very clearly and closely. The decisions you make on how you react and be with one another will make the difference in the trajectory of lives. Be very careful and clear about what I'm saying. I said, because if there was judgment and harshness, and to me as I was going through this, really, honestly, I don't think I would have really come back to the church or really been at this place where I am. You know, if my dad hadn't done that and he did berate me, I probably would have like left Bible college that day and honestly never returned and probably lost myself in the scene, the club scene. Like really, so the decisions of others have also have impacted me and where my life is going.
Yeah.
And
might have been why Jesus harped on that so much.
Exactly. And so I people go, "But, you know, Melinda, you are really lucky," or, you know, "because that hasn't been my experience. Like, why you?" And I said, I mean, I never sit in the whys. It's never about why, because I could go crazy about whys.
Yeah.
I just say, now what? Like, what am I going to do with it? I said, you know, I don't know why, because that's not really the right question to be asking me. It's now like, what do I do with that? And my hope is that I share that story to encourage the church when I go to churches, because really, like, it was just like immediate. I went with trembling and trepidation to my workplace, thinking I'm on national Christian TV. They're immediately going to like kick me off and be like, "Sorry." And immediately, I'll never forget, they said, "We would never hurt or shoot or wounded. We will care for you all this time. We'll keep you on the air. If you can't do some shows that are too hard, you don't have to do them. But we will love you through this. You're going to stay on. We're going to give you a job. We're going to love you." And I remember sitting there in the green room, by the studio bawling my eyes out going, but my expectation was you were going to. And they were like, no. We're going to love you. You know, going to, you know, the meeting house and the board expecting, well, as a leader, you can't be on the board if you're going through this. And then Brexy and Tim going, no, that's silly. Your brain is still working. Yeah. You have many good things to say. Yeah. You're going to stay on. And then at that point, because at that time I'd, you know, I needed work. And so the meeting house immediately said, you know what, in a very practical way, we'll give you a part-time job. So it was like people just rallied. Yeah. And so I really am the recipient of such great love from people. It's really, it's pretty amazing. I want to be careful because some people have said to me, you know, there has been people who have said that seems so unfair because so many people haven't received that. You know, what do you say to that? I just say, well, I don't know. You know, I think then the responsibility for me is then to share that goodness, you know, to others and encourage the church to be that, you know, to be that kind of love to one another.
So is that, kind of wrapping up now, is that the power of story? It's incredible that I'm always harping about story. It's in my kind of by title. And for you have a radio show, right? Your Story with Melinda. Yeah. You're eliciting stories from people. So clearly you have this conviction about the power of stories, telling your story. Mm-hmm. What is that? What is that power of story?
You know, when I got the opportunity to do this radio show, and it's Your Story with Melinda, I was like, you know, I was trying to figure out the title, and I was trying to figure out what this was about, and I realized, wait a sec. I have found that people learn the best when they hear story. Because I've sat through, I mean, listen, I love learning. I went to Bible college. I love listening to smart people and, you know, get my 1, 2, 3 points of how to live a great life and all that kind of stuff.
You're about to throw lecturing under the bus right now.
Maybe, possibly. And to all my profs and pastors, I love you. However, I have seen what story does. Mm-hmm. I've seen when I'm speaking, when people hear a story, how their eyes light up and then how they can relate. And I've realized, and God has really kind of spoken to me to say that's the power of it. Because when people realize they can relate on some level, when they realize that everybody's on the same level, because in my stories, I always sort of bring myself, especially being TV. TV makes people crazy. It's like you're above them. And that was the hardest part about that kind of stuff. And it's like, no, I'm actually just like you. And when you start telling story, you're all on the same level. Right. It's like this sort of equal sort of balance of where you're at. And then people are way more open to share about themselves, ask for help, ask for prayer. And so I felt that with the power of story, it's number one, everybody has a story. Yeah. It's not like, you know, there are people said, well, I've never done that. I've never been on TV. Well, no, you haven't, but you have a story. Oh, so again, we're sort of like, you know, equaling everybody to say everybody has a story. Everybody can share it and have an opportunity. It doesn't mean you have to share it on TV or on radio, but you can share it with friends or neighbors or your kids. And the power of a story is that then we can all learn from one another through that. Every part of a story has a learning, whether you make good decisions or bad. And so, you know, the show Your Story with Melinda is about that. I actually learn a lot from my guests. It's crazy. I always think that, you know, they're going to learn so much from me. Well, I hope they do. But a lot of it is I learn from them. And a lot of it is, you know, we have such varied backgrounds, and yet we always find these threads of sameness.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Whether they're 65 or they're an artist or a singer or whatever they are, we're all like, man, that's like me. I love that. And then we laugh hysterically and we're like, man, you know, we all are so much the same.
Yeah.
And that is what I love. So there, because I've noticed even in the Christian world, everybody's on different levels. Whether you're like, you have your PhD, there's that level or this and that. And when you start sharing story, we all kind of like,
yeah, it's the equalizer. It's an equalizer. That we need.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I love. I love the story. And I think I have a pretty compelling story myself.
Yeah, this was all right. First time my eyes teared up. As an interviewer, was with Melinda Esterbrooks. Put that one in the books. I'm going to give you a second to shill yourself here. So Your Story with Melinda is on Joy 1250.
Right, at noon on Saturdays.
Okay.
And then again,
noon on Saturdays.
Throughout the week.
Okay, it bounces around.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or maybe I really should know those days of
or
the
week. Or it's through the app on demand. I know that.
Yep, it is.
I listen to you usually on demand. I don't have an AM radio. But
okay, yeah. Yep, thank
and
you.
And then your blog. I want to talk about it because it's good. I mean, I know you're ashamed that you don't blog enough, but whatever. There's like 8 entries, but they're good. It's
shame.
Like a mini book, but yes. Man, it was really good stuff there. So
thank you.
Somebody could sit down and take 45 minutes to read your blog. You know, because
it's almost like you're like encouraging me with a little
I am.
Poke.
Well, let's, yeah, it's really good stuff.
You know
stuff.
What? I think I'm actually, it's funny because when I was coming in here, I was actually thinking to myself, I need to write a new blog this weekend.
Yeah. Okay. But you speak a lot too. So
I
like,
do. I do speak a lot.
I mean, so there's that. Like, do you want to be blogging all the time when you're speaking so much? So
no, but I do need to blog. I mean, it's more of a discipline to write. It's easier for me to speak, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But writing is something I love. I have journals since I was 13. Mm. Volumes of journals. So wow. I just need to kind of like pull some of that stuff out and put it in.
And you've got some speaking gigs in the new year, I would imagine.
Yeah, lots of speaking gigs. A lot out west, like Alberta. And then a lot of different women's groups and churches. Okay. So, and it's funny because I've been speaking for a long time, but I just got my website like a year ago.
Yeah. So which now, is?
MelindaEsterbrooks.com.
Okay.
And so now I'm getting more random speaking. Most of this, my speaking came from people that kind of knew me or through other friends.
Yeah.
This one are people who literally Googled Christian Women Speakers Canada.
Wow.
And then I popped up on my website and that's how I'm getting gigs. So I'm like, awesome.
Nice,
that's cool. So that's been really great.
Yeah.
It's really good.
MelindaEsterbrooks.com.
Yes.
And Your Story with Melinda.
Yes.
Amazing. I'm done asking you questions. Is there anything else you wanted to put out there? Are you feeling good about this?
I am feeling good.
Okay,
I think the last thing I just want to say is I think what you're doing is awesome.
Oh, okay.
I mean, here's the thing.
No
one's really interviewed me for 45 minutes.
Yeah, you were really weirded out by that.
I know. Isn't that weird? Because whenever you turn it on, the person who always does the interview, it is a strange feeling. So I appreciate that. And actually, I think I need to do it more because as I was speaking with you, I was getting these other feelings and thoughts going, oh, so that's how I really feel about this. Because sometimes you don't articulate it in the way that you do when you're speaking out there.
When somebody else invades your
train
of thought.
Yes.
You're like, oh, yeah.
Yes. And
I saw that in your eyes a lot. Like, what? Just in the last 45 minutes. Yeah. Huh. Like, what is
you're being
what is
so,
happening
you were
right
intrusive. But no, it was really good. And so I thank you for that. I think that I need to do this once every while because I think everybody should do that. Maybe I should interview you sometime.
Okay. Thank you for opening yourself up to intrusion today.
Okay. Anytime, Mark. No, thank you. That was awesome. I really had a great time.
Oh, man. Well, there you go. What a story. What a great time. Check out Melinda's Your Story with Melinda here on faithstrongtoday.com. Just pan over a couple pages over on this very website. And visit MelindaEsterbrooks.com as well to find out what she's doing and where she's speaking next and all that sort of thing. I'm sure she's got new projects coming up for the new year here. And now make sure you subscribe to WikiGod on Faith Strong Today so you never miss an uncut episode of the show. To connect with me, email me at mark@wikigodpod.com. You can tweet me at Mark Roller at WikiGodPod on Twitter. I love hearing your thoughts and feedback. Join us again right here on Faith Strong Today next week when we are Wikiing God with Brett McBride. He is currently the lead pastor of the People's Church in Toronto and the former executive director of Urban Promise Toronto. He and I have a lot to talk about. We cover everything, so you don't want to miss that. See you then. Until then, thanks for Wikiing.
Thanks for listening to WikiGod, presented by Faith Strong Today. Share this episode on social media and find more great programs at faithstrongtoday.com.